Okay, so thank you for coming back, for joining us again. This is the second half of LA Lit with Chris Krause. And I think we're just going to start with a reading from Torpor, and then we will open the floor to audience questions. There is a well-placed microphone up here on a stool, which you can use to ask questions if you're asking questions of Chris. Just say your name, just so you know we know who you are. And I believe you have to turn the microphone on, because we don't want to hear that kind of like jumbly sound when you pick up the microphone. It's, you know, kind of, yeah, not so good. So, but anyway, if you want to just talk a little bit about Torpor and then start.
Yeah, okay. Well, in Torpor, Chris and Sylvia have become characters called Sylvia and Jerome. The book is written in the third person, and it more or less takes the form of a road trip. It's set in 1991. And Sylvia and Jerome set off on a road trip through Eastern Europe with the kind of dubious quest of adopting a Romanian orphan. This is after they've had, you know, three abortions of perfectly viable pregnancies of their own. Jerome absolutely does not want a child. The real backstory here is Jerome's own background as a child survivor of the Holocaust. That has completely colored his life, and he already has a child. He can't deal with another child. He has this younger wife who's now in her mid-30s and really, really wants a child. So he figures to placate her, they will take a trip around Eastern Europe. After all, the Berlin Wall came down in 89, and the Soviet bloc has started to fall. And Jerome, who grew up in Europe as a communist, really wants a chance to see these East European countries before they change forever. And that's an important part of the book, too, sort of placing it in time that way in 1991, which I see as really like it was a very pivotal time. Is, you know, the end of a homogeneous avant-garde of any kind, the end of there being sort of scenes concentrated in particular cities, the beginning of a sort of more international wash of culture and a greater exchangeability. There was already MTV. There was not the internet yet. And there was also a kind of consciousness among people that the world was changing in a very radical way, but nobody could say exactly how. So that's kind of the backdrop. They're in Berlin. Jerome is in Berlin on a DAAD fellowship, and he keeps being invited to do things and go here and there. He's very well known at this time. And they can't get out of Berlin. They keep postponing their departure. So this is the one last meeting that he has before they finally leave Berlin for Romania. The other thing I want to say, I guess, is that they finally do get to Romania after all this travel, and it's unbelievably horrifying. And I wanted to have Romania in the book as a kind of extrapolation of Jerome's own misery through his immersion in history as a Holocaust survivor, to see an entire nation kind of trapped in this troglodyte state that was very much brought on by their own racisms and national hatreds and nationalisms, which is, you know, Romanian history is just fraught with that. And to see this country that's been kind of exiled to live in the Middle Ages while other East European countries join the rest of the, you know, neoliberal global world. So that's the paradigm again. You know, their couple is the paradigm, and Romania is part of the larger world. Jerome's last meeting in Berlin was with the poets Sasha Anderson and Gerhard Wagner. Both in their early 30s, the two men made a winning and unlikely team. Faulkner was one of West Germany's leading younger literary personalities. Anderson, a neo-Dadaist, had grown up in the former East. When both of them were in their early teens, their lives were changed forever when they read a German hippie book called Acid Culture Lit. They didn't know each other then, and neither of them had actually tried acid yet. But when they pored over the first translations into German of the American beat writers, they knew the dated wall of guilt and culture that separated both Berlins from the real world was about to crumble. Being young was finally more significant than being German. In August 1991, almost 2 years since the physical demolition of the Berlin Wall, they figured it was time to do a sequel. They'd heard Jerome was in Berlin that summer. They'd read his magazine and heard about the cultural events he'd organized among philosophers and terrorists and pedophiles in William Burroughs. Maybe Jerome could help them figure out who was hot within the American literary counterculture. They already had a former Eastern publisher. He'd be their third co-editor. The project was surprisingly well-funded. They'd pay him several $1,000s. He'd get to pick which writers to invite on a lavish German tour. Towards this end, an impromptu gathering is organized at Sasha's. Sasha lives in a cavernous ground floor apartment in Prince Lauerberg. Though considerably less gentrified than Kreuzberg, it's fast become the Kreuzberg of the former East. The apartment seems to be inhabited by many people. It's hard to tell how many of them actually live there. When Jerome arrives with Sylvie, 6 or 8 young guys who seem like Sasha's friends or followers are already spread out on thrift store couches in the living room, excitedly discussing countercultural trends and drinking beers. There are also several women, but they stay in the kitchen with a handful of small children. Though Sylvie stayed away from most of Jerome's Berlin events, she insists on coming with him to this meeting. Unlike Jerome's other projects, this anthology concerns her. It is something she can do. Unlike Jerome, she reads a great deal of American poetry and fiction. Before she married him, she worked at a poetry center in New York. She knows the St. Mark's poets. She knows the Buddhist poets exiled in Bolinas. She knows the language poets, too. In fact, since 1989, she'd edited a fiction series for Jerome's Press, a kind of occupational therapy they've devised to fill the thousands of spare hours she has while waiting for her films to be funded. The series features first-person fiction writing by Sylvie's friends and former friends. Because most of them are women, Sylvie sees the series as a philosophical intervention. Though written in the first person, the books are well-constructed rants, not introspective memoirs. Finally, she thinks, a female public eye aimed outward towards the world, more revolutionary than the 20th century male avant-gardes. This is the only countercultural trend worth mentioning. Still, no one in Jerome's Hoost peaked crowd recognizes these as Sylvie Green's ideas because his name appears before hers on the masthead. Though he hasn't had the time to read these women's books, the press, he reasons, is his artwork. What's more, his name gives their work an added credibility. They fight about this constantly, though most of Sylvia's friends and former friends agree. Walking through Prince Lauerberg from the Karl Marx U-Bahn, Sylvie shakes off the torpor that has gripped her since arriving in Berlin. Unlike Jerome's other Berlin contacts, Anderson and Faulkner aren't aging hippie types. They're Sylvie's age, so they must be her contemporaries. Though as soon as they set foot in Sasha's place, she starts to wonder, why aren't there any women at the meeting? Why are all the other females speaking German in the kitchen? Since she does not speak German, the men don't mind her sitting with her husband in the living room. On one wall, there are several neo-expressionist paintings inspired roughly by de Kooning's women. Sylvie sits beneath the one of two enormous cunt lips sprouting fangs. The Germans grill Jerome about the literary scene in New York City. Has any special group replaced the Beats? Who's peaked? Why did Burroughs leave his bunker on the Bowery for Lawrence, Kansas? What about the poetry wars of the mid-80s? The language school, the neo-New York school? The neo-objectivists, Ferlinghetti, John Giorno, Carl Riccosi. Jerome doesn't have a clue. He, in fact, avoids the poets with their petty feuds and righteous poverty. Endlessly competitive and introspective, they live in dumpy slum apartments and would knife each other for $5. Jerome prefers the painters and the filmmakers who live in Soho and Tribeca. There's money there. At least the things they fight about are real. Sylvie thinks about her poet friends who started bands and bravely sealed their own obscurity by adopting arcane names that reference things no one but the poets know or care about. As an inverse snob, she finds their willful amateurism magnificently punk and appealing. They'd grown up working class, dropped out of mediocre schools, and learned everything themselves by reading. The poets all sold speed and sat around the floor on mattresses discussing Robert Herrick and John Donne. She finds their self-taught erudition more sublime than Jerome's Who's Peaked form of recognition. Still, each time she argues with Jerome about her credit, he insists that credit doesn't really count. After all, she's not a writer, she's a filmmaker. But as she watches Sasha Anderson and Gerhard Faulkner eagerly solicit Jerome's thoughts about contemporary literature, She thinks, I'm 35 years old. Everything I do now has to matter. Jerome is fascinated by the cultural differences between his two new German sponsors. Faulkner, who's obviously of the West, seems to be the front man of the operation. Although Sasha has the money, and quite a lot of it, it seems, despite the anarchistic mess of the apartment. Instinctively, Jerome takes Sasha for a Jew. Unlike Faulkner with his movie star good looks, Anderson is small and rumpled and alert. Though Anderson isn't really Jewish, 10 months from now he'll be described as débrouillard, a word that's practically synonymous with Jew, in a long New Yorker article by Janet Kramer. Débrouillard in French means a small and shifty hustler. Sasha's poetry, it seems, is less accessible than Gerhard Faulkner's. Delivered as a threat, his poems are clumps of words describing disparate things, as if non sequiturs comprised a new form of anarchist polemic, as Kramer noted later. Anderson's modest attempts at neo-dada only came under Kramer's scrutiny when he was denounced as a Stasi spy by Wolf Biermann, a well-known hippie folk singer. The fact that Anderson could recite his driveling diatribes in bars and then phone in a list of names to his superior on the same evening was appalling both to Biermann and Kramer, as if half the East German population had not been charged for 30 years with spying on the other. Soon after Jerome Cash's, as it turned out, Stasi-funded check, Kramer would meticulously describe his host's red beard, his darting rat-like eyes, his ironic, arrogant demeanor. As the afternoon wears on, Anderson and Faulkner press Jerome to help them make a list of possible contributors. The three men reel off the names of other men, all white. Sylvie finds the reality of this unbearable. Finally, she says, you know, there aren't any women on the list, though no one in the room has asked her. Still, she's been around this world for 15 years and knows that there are never any women on the list unless someone consciously decides to put them there. The names that spring to mind perennially as edgy but still credible are invariably male. And yet the writers she admires most are female. What about Bernadette and Gail, Alice and Eileen and Anne and Susie, she offers? No one in the room has heard of any of these writers. Most of them are dykes. The rest look like they might be. The men just gape as Sylvie mounts a passionate defense of how female lived experience can be channeled through poetic avant-gardist forums, but in the process changes them. Thoroughly embarrassed, Jerome thinks fast for a compromise. What about, he ventures, Kathy Acker? Sylvie presses her thin lips tight and glares at him. At this moment, Acker is in London, at a peak of notoriety that only certain literary men enjoy. As famous as an actress or a female rock star, she's accomplished this by distancing herself from all the dowdy women Sylvie's mentioned. Acker understands that writing without myth is nothing, and female myths don't run in groups. They're always singular. The image she's invented for herself is every bit as radical and striking as her writing. With her shaved head, red ruby lips and muscles, she shows off her tattoos in vintage lingerie. At other times, she wears a muscle shirt and boots and rides a Harley. Her photographs are everywhere, the face, ID, and interview. And better still, one of her books has just been banned in Germany as child pornography. Of course, thinks Sylvie, if there has to be a woman, Acker would be it. Her books seduce and challenge heterosexual men. Her photos just seduce them. Sylvie once saw the anti-censorship crusader Karen Finley play the paramount. In a black satin corset and spike heels, Finley raped herself with yams to cheers from frat boys in the audience. Was it a coincidence that she and Kathy Acker were the only female artists in their world to get anywhere near the mainstream? Why could the famous artist men be friends, the women just competitors? Was sex still the only passport to success if you were straight and female? Across the globe in 1991, in Yugoslavia, New York, and Kreuzberg, wars were being fought for meanings, which 5 years later would seem quaint, 5 years later still unfathomable. Acker's name was added to the list. It was an excellent idea. She'd come on tour. She'd be the headliner.
Well, we wanted to open up the floor to audience questions. If anybody out there has any questions for Chris, there's a microphone right up here. You're welcome to use it. Let me repeat that. So just because it can be on the recording.
I don't hear well. And so he's going to repeat the question to the audience.
And just so it's on the recording, she was asking, would it matter who Dick was exactly? Could he be anybody? Or did he have to be the particular person that he was? Is that, yeah?
Oh, Dick?
Yeah, but yeah.
His profession.
Oh,
well, his profession, no, I don't think it could have been anybody. It mattered a great deal who he was. The fact that he had quite a reputation, was very well known, and took a certain pose within a particular world, you know, the sort of underground outlaw cowboy of the sort of underground avant-garde guard wing of the art world, this was very important. Because that was my world, too, at the time. And I felt that my experience in that world had been very different from his, and that was something that I really needed to talk about.
Any other questions? I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Also, there's another part to that answer.
Oh.
I actually really admired his writing a great deal and learned a lot from reading it. So it couldn't have been anybody. A lot of my writing was riffing and spinning off from reading his writing. So it was as much a conversation with his writing as it was with my fantasy of who he might be.
Yeah, I mean, if there's other questions, if you guys can use the microphone so it's on the recording, that'd be great. Sorry, thanks.
How many times did you actually communicate with Dick after the initial meeting? None or very few?
Oh.
How many times did you actually communicate with Dick after the initial meetings? Was it none or very few? Or
after the initial meeting, we communicated three more times. And these times are all well documented in the book.
But they were all at the beginning, pretty much. Is that true?
They were at the beginning and the middle, although not at the end.
So do you find that he became more fictional as the process went forward, in the way you treated him literarily?
He became all too real at a certain point.
I guess my sense is that were you, in a certain way, inventing a Dick
One can go on inventing people over a long, long period of time. It can go on for 7 or 8 years. So yes, even though I just watched the movie Swan's Way, the beautiful French movie of Swan's Way in black and white, and that's all about how these romances and infatuations, you know, in that culture could take place. You know, you could have lovers, you could have mistresses and lovers who would be in your life for 7 years. And that's because it wasn't just about sex, of course. It was about fantasy and projection and intrigue and games and jealousy. So it's possible to fabulate over a very, very long period of time. So the fact that I actually, you know, had a real-life meeting with Dick, that I spent a night with Dick, did not stop the projection in any way at all. I mean, of course, once a person becomes integrated into your life in another way, that stops.
Right. following on to that, I was also wondering about the sort of amalgamation of, I guess, I'm not sure if structuralist is the right word, but between structuralism, if that's the right word, and romanticism. You're sort of moving fuzzily between the two and moving towards romanticism, I think. Is that accurate?
Could you define structuralism and romanticism?
In the most banal sense of being romantic, and structuralism, I'm not sure if I'm choosing the correct word because I don't know much of your oeuvre. So I'm wondering if you're going from a maybe theoretical, it'd be a more, you know, from a broadly theoretical way of writing towards a romantic way.
Structuralism is the greatest romance.
Oh, come on, give me something. Come on, give me something more than that.
No, it's true. It's true. I mean, to kind of pluck something out of the kind of muck and murk of daily life and to give it a form is really the greatest romance that there is. And the more that we kind of, you know, compartmentalize something and put it under a microscope and study it, the more romantic and invested in it becomes. I mean, what is, you know, what does the other word mean, romance, really?
Well, it's
a swooning, a losing of oneself.
Yeah, and also a giving over to emotion, you know, as opposed to
giving over to emotion as opposed to a intellectual analysis or something like that.
Yeah, but I've never seen the difference. I mean, to me, the beginning of the book is even more emotional than the end of the book. It's completely emotional. And the more analytic it is, the more emotional it is. I mean, I've never seen an opposition between theory and emotion, between philosophy and experience.
Do you think that criticism sort of wants to see that dichotomy?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, that's kind of what gives philosophy and criticism a bad name, is that philosophy becomes so exiled from the body. And so, you know, it becomes an abstraction of an abstraction. You know, it's like this rationalist thing about the head being high and the body being low. But, of course, not all philosophers are like that. You know, the hero, I guess, of most people these days or recently has been Deleuze, and he's a very great philosopher who has this amazing totality and range of experience in his writing. But many, many philosophers do. I mean, philosophy is like poetry. Philosophy is like a poetry of ideas, and it's very active. And when you read philosophy, when you read the best philosophy, you're watching this person work through this very difficult and dense material and move from one place to another to get to a certain point. And, you know, what could be more emotional than that?
Yeah. I don't know. I'll think about it.
On that, maybe what you were talking about, even in the part in Torpor, you mentioned, like, the kind of genius of a female public eye moving beyond the kind of the avant-garde male kind of world that you had said even before reading the book had at this point in Torpor had crumbled, like these kind of avant-gardes had kind of disappeared or something. And so in this question that we were talking about here, it's like you're making a case for this kind of emotional theory, or, you know, and in your books you're going through really emotional material, and yet you're sprinkling all this really great kind of social critique, art critique. Can you talk about maybe that more, to even illuminate that question more, just talk about that as a practice that you've chosen to take up?
Well, if you care enough about something, you want to understand it, and then you will proceed to understand it by any means necessary. And theory and philosophy are tools through which we understand things.
Right. Good answer.
And so, yes, the female eye as a polemical eye, maybe we could talk about that for a minute.
Yeah.
I think it's a really important presence, this presence of the female eye that is not, you know, a psychoanalytic eye. That's not a that's not necessarily a confessional eye. And the culture seems to be extremely resistant to accepting this, to accepting a woman's first-person voice as any kind of universal and not, you know, as a pathology of this kind of fucked-up individual. I mean, we've had this so recently, like, what was the book a few years ago, Catherine Maillot? You know, the sex book? You know, that was a real sneer fest.
Huh.
Do you remember the book I'm talking about? Anybody remember? You know, Veronica, you must know. You know, she worked for Art News, and she kept a diary of all of her, like, hundreds of sexual encounters. You don't know the book? Oh. Oh, well, I mean, it was, you know, pretty kind of conventional, I guess, modernist form, you know, the sort of sex log. But it was written by this woman who had actually quite a high position in the art world, made it deeply, deeply repugnant. You know, so the book became really about her sort of sickness and her childhood and what could lead her to do this and be this way than anything she might be saying. I mean, and nobody has ever done this with, like, Henry Miller, with Alexander Trocchi, with right. any of the male 20th century avant-garde writers.
Do you think that that reaction would... Is that just in the United States, that kind of reaction? Or is that sort of a in Europe, too, for example?
Well, I know Baudrillard wrote a really kind of sneery, icky review of that in Le Bay. No, I think that she was kind of universally...
There was also... Claire Massoud wrote an article for The New Yorker about this problem, about the problem of a woman dealing with her sexuality in a literary way, in a book. Either literary or memoir. She was talking about Catherine Harrison, the woman that wrote The Kiss. Uh-huh. And she brought this up as well, that men have historically been able to and encouraged to write about their sexuality as a way of experiencing the world, and that women are immediately jumped on any time that their sexuality comes onto the page, or that a character's sexuality comes onto the page. And the fact that a character is immediately equated with the author in a woman's book in the way that it's not in a man's book, even when it's first person, like in Portnoy's Complaint. You allow Philip Roth or any male writer to write about a character who has a sexual life in a way that you don't allow that in a woman author. Immediately the two get conflated, the narratorial voice and the author.
I think that's really true. Yeah. That's really true. Another part of the sort of the female eye as a polemical eye, I think, is this kind of girl tendency of extreme and radical empathy, which I think is a much more female voice than a male voice. And I really like that voice. I was just reading this new book by a younger poet today, Ariana Raines, and it really had that voice, that kind of empathy to the point of near schizophrenia. It's very much a girl thing, and it's very beautiful to sort of see that as a philosophy voice, too.
Is someone like, you know, Anais Nin, where does she fall in that equation?
She's romantic.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as the way the male system treated her, because Henry Miller got banned everywhere, too. And I'm just wondering, are there any women that are able to get above that and be treated seriously when they do that kind of narrative at all, or none?
Well, I think that A.M. Holmes in The End of Alice achieved that to a great degree. I mean, first she uses initials A.M., so if she said Anne Marie Holmes, she might have gotten more shit. Even though people know it's a woman, it's written from a place that is more protected and more gender neutral, so that she was able to write about this pedophile in a very, very graphic way, but it didn't bounce back on her. It was treated more like a male book. So that's good, but I mean, it's not as profoundly interesting as seeing if there's not a way for a more... totally female voice to be accepted as a universal voice. I mean, that's a more important problem to me.
Now, most of that's because men are controlling the biz, right?
I don't know.
I mean, you know, there's a chauvinism that's only about 15 centuries old that is, you know, it's ongoing. And I, as you say, you know, they always pick men to be on the list. So you're. I mean, it's kind of banal to say, but you're always up against this good old boy network in a certain way, even in the most rarefied literary circles and philosophical circles in a certain way. In that sense, what I'm kind of wondering is, I often wonder why the very smart, together female artists in general, writers, whatever, don't just kind of fuck them off and go like, well, who cares what you guys think? You know, and more so than they do.
They do, and then they end up in TVs.
And then, yeah.
Well, but yeah, okay, that's fair.
Can you Chris, can you talk about, has that changed? Has any of that changed since, like, I mean, you were writing that scene in Kreutzberg or whatever, and like that was 90 or 91. Has it changed in the last 15 years even? That kind of, that they're never on the list unless someone decides to, like, consciously put them there? Has that even changed in 15 years?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. There were all these great kind of dyke things happening in the mid and late 90s. You know, groups like Sister Spit, Michelle T, we published her first book, and she had this group in San Francisco called Sister Spit, this lesbian performance poetry group that went like all over America, every podunk town, every dyke bar. And, you know, they created this culture by themselves. They were incredibly dedicated and supportive of each other. I mean, that's the other thing about what you say. It's like cartoon programmers always have, like, boy protagonists because they figure boys like boys and girls like boys. So that doesn't leave many people liking girls. That girls would rather watch boys than watch other girls. So a lot of that comes from women ourselves, you know, being interested in the work of other women and taking it seriously.
Yeah, well, it's you know, it's part of the edifice of chauvinism. I mean, clearly some of the, like, you know, the New York Dadaists, you know, when they, I guess they got, or Duchamp, or some of them got kicked out of the secessionist show in 1915 or so, and they were basically, you know, expelled from their own underground secession movement, you know. So I often wonder, you know, how important the mainstream literary criticism, you know, literary philosophical criticism world really is. Often it seems to me, in retrospect, unfortunately, often after the writer dies, but they end up achieving more notoriety for having bucked that system than they do for having played along in any way.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing about modernism.
It is. I mean,
I think we're kind of more at a point now where, like, it doesn't matter and nothing much matters. I mean, things come and go so quickly. It's hard to say what really does make an impact.
Now, do you see a direction for, I mean, there's a lot going on in the world right now. Do you see a thrust that you'd like to see, say, American literature move in to change the subject a little bit?
Well, that would be kind of a grandiose hope.
Something like you'd like to see more of now that history is where it is.
Yeah. Of course, the problem with sort of the literary world in America is that it's like more and more hegemonic, and it's more and more geared towards very, very commercial trade books, and books that would have been published by a commercial trade press 10 or 20 years ago now are published by independent presses, because if a book doesn't sell 40,000 copies in hardback, they can't do it anymore. So, I mean, that's a weird thing, because in the 40s and 50s, there were writers like Don Powell, you know, great writers who would, like, pop out book after book after book. They had a career doing this, and yet they'd only sell 5,000-6,000 copies of some novels. And that's not a viable career anymore. I mean, likewise, all of this great kind of pulp fiction arose because those guys were making enough money off a story to live on for a week or two. So there was a whole industry of people writing stories and books of these stories. And that, you know, that industry doesn't really exist anymore. It's hard to think of any reason to write a short story.
Do you think that's because the proliferation of editors? You know, I notice the one thing I've noticed in American filmmaking is that there is, as the system goes on and becomes more ingrained through, you know, through time, there are these rather severe and unspoken orthodoxies that just take over completely. And I'm wondering, you know, do you see a way out of that for American literary? Because I guess what I'm getting at is that there's so many editors that are picking so many small books and doing one or two books with that person, then moving on to someone else. Do you see it as an editorial sort of problem that editors are getting too scattered and they're not focusing enough on the really high quality material or something to that effect? Or do you think it's just a product of proliferation of media, perhaps, or proliferation of access?
And Chris, can you talk about maybe a little bit like what you do with what you're doing with Semiotext, your own editorial interests maybe? In that?
Yeah, what we're doing with Semiotext is books that we really, really like a lot.
Right.
That we think we have to do. And, you know, we've changed the fiction list somewhat. We kind of came to an end of the road with the sort of 90s first-person female fiction thing.
Yeah.
The last book in that set was Jane DeLynn's Leash.
Okay.
And after that, we moved on to doing science fiction. We did Venusia by Mark von Schlegel and first American translation of Maurice Dantec, Babylon Babies,
right.
Which is actually going to be a big movie with Ben Diesel.
And then are you publishing another Dantec book or something? Is there another Dantec book that you guys were going to publish?
No, we just did Babylon.
Okay.
Yeah, we just did Babylon. And we're doing Veronica Gonzalez's new book next year, and we're doing Catherine Breuer. We're doing a book by the filmmaker Catherine Breuer called Pornocracy. And things like that.
Huh.
Oh, and we're thinking about doing a kind of sub-series of writers who we like a lot, literary writers who we like writing criticism, because we all do. I can't think of a fiction writer who doesn't also write criticism in our world, so we might do like a set of smaller, shorter books of people doing kind of a polemical criticism.
Nice. And then I don't know if there are any other questions.
One more last question. About your process as a writer with point of view from I Love Dick to Torpor, which is a third-person narrative in which you've taken these two characters and made them these third-person characters. And I think that one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that you'd like to be able to instill humor into the work. And so I think that I got that from you already, that really gave you a lot more room for that, for the self-deprecating humor. But I wanted to know a little bit more about the process, what it was like for you to go from this first person as a writer to a third person with characters.
When I wrote Torpor, I kind of realized pretty early that it had to be in the third person because it was so personal.
Did you start it in the first person?
No. Okay. I never started it in the first person. I started the book in my notebooks, and even in my notebooks, I found it much easier to kind of get in and talk about what I needed to by calling them character names, because it was so painful and so icky, and it didn't feel right, and it was very inhibiting to try and do it in the first person. So no, I immediately did it in the third. And I don't know about that in the future. I mean, Jerome and Sylvie, of course, are ciphers for two people that I know very well. And I don't know about this thing about making characters up out of the clear blue sky. I mean, I know that people do that and writers are supposed to be able to do it. I can't quite imagine doing that. I think, you know, for me, it always has to come from somewhere close. I mean, that's also the difference between the kind of fiction that I write and that I like and a more plot-driven book. A lot of the plot-driven books that we read, they have characters, sure, but these characters are not particularly like anybody that we know in real life. The character just doesn't matter that much. The character is pretty indistinguishable. And I guess books that are much more kind of character-rich are books that are more autobiographical. I really believe that the best fiction is always on some level autobiographical.
Well, if there are no more questions, do we want to close out with a short reading from Video Green?
Sure.
Any other questions? And then that'll be it.
Panda porn. It's a nondescript day, all emptiness and breathless heat, and I'm driving through Fontana East along the 10. There are a lot of billboards. Smelly credit? Psst, I'm at Flesh. The spearmint rhino girl gazes straight ahead, all ivory and pink, and I'm wondering how her face achieves its state of pornographic blankness. Unlike the blankness of contemporary art, which references the futility of gesture, her blankness is a verb, and the viewer its direct object. Her blankness is an invitation to ejaculate against the surface of her face. Her face says, "Come all over me." Beyond the spearmint rhino girl, there's another billboard with a picture of a giant panda. Fine China.
The panda glances at me shyly, escaped to the San Diego Zoo. She is trying to conceal her round and fluffy body behind a single bamboo stalk, a modest gesture that's as futile and endearing as the girl in the skin-tight sweater wondering why everyone is staring at her breasts. It's retro panda porn. She seems to be the last one of her species, or nearly. I remember having seen her once 3 years ago when I visited the San Diego Zoo. Jai, the new age dom who I was dating, chose this outing as a special treat. For 5 days, he'd been ejaculating against the surface of my face in a Mexican hotel, and this visit to the zoo would be a culminating celebration of my newfound feminine identity. Everybody knows that girls love pandas. They're fluffy and adorable, even when they're incarcerated in zoos. And what is the adorable, if not an invocation against everything that it's not? The ribbons and the bows, the yellows and the pinks, the tendrils of ivy in little clay pots, the desire to be cocooned within a cloud of prettiness, all reek of death and decay. I remember this trip to the zoo as a vision of department store hell. The San Diego Zoo is a series of money extraction points done up as kiosks, cleverly linked by simulated habitat exhibits through which the movement of crowds is planned and controlled. All points lead to the pandas, the money shot, the zoo's star attraction. At the time Jai and I visited, there were just two, the captive-raised female Ba Yun and Shi Shi, a male born in China's remote Sichuan province. As panda lore has it, Shi Shi was mortally wounded in a territorial fight with another male panda, found by a peasant, and rescued by foresters who, quote, brought the dying panda to China's Wulong Giant Panda Research Center, where he was literally stitched back together. Zoo news. Shi Shi was then shipped to America. On the verge of extinction, with less than 1,000 pandas left in the wild, everyone waited for Ba Yun and Shi Shi to mate. Sassy Ba Yun did her best. She exhibited all the right panda mating behavior, but Shi Shi rejected her. He was an asocial panda, perhaps homosexual. Did Ba Yun blame herself? Despite her desire to mate, she could not overcome Shi Shi's negativity. Finally, after 3 years, veterinary technology intervened. Vials of sperm were obtained from a reluctant Shi Shi. Zoo News gives no details about how this was done. But after several attempts, Ba Yun became pregnant and Hua Mei was born. Now an array of webcams broadcast Hua Mei's every move 24/7 live over the web. Landscaped and curved to give the illusion of space, all the zoo's walkways converge at the Pacific Bell Panda Research Station, which is Hua Mei's home. Spectators approach the station on a long concrete ramp that slopes downwards, a bit like an abattoir, elaborately guarded by rails. The crowd moves slowly but steadily. Inside the station, Jai and I stepped onto a moving floor that took us from one end of a plexiglass wall to another. It lasted about 90 seconds, but this was the panda view. Sure enough, Hua Mei and her mother were there. "Ooh, look at the pandas," I dutifully squealed. Did the 25 minutes we'd spent to achieve it increase the view's value? The San Diego Zoo's manipulation of spectators and what it tells about our relation to the disappearance of nature is highly complex. I wanted to investigate further. Perhaps it would be worthwhile to compare the San Diego Zoo's soft curatorial strategies with the unreconstructed 19th century menagerie at Paris's Jardin des Plantes. At Jardin des Plantes, no effort is made to place the animals in simulated natural habitats. It is a zoo, a place where people come to look at the animals. It's not very different from France's first zoo, the Cabinet of King Charles. Built in the mid-18th century, the cabinet was a collection of strange zoological specimens brought back from the colonies and wild lands beyond. Here they were cataloged by the Comte de Buffon. In his illustrated history and description of the animals, 1755, the great naturalist writes, "The stupidest man is able to guide the most spiritual of animals. Man is a being of reason. Animal is a being without reason." And yet a trip to the Jardin des Plantes is always a pleasure. Its only concessions are postcards and ice cream. Within just a few acres of shaggy chestnut trees, sidewalks, enclosures, and green wooden fences, the Jardin fulfills Frederick Law Olmsted's utopian vision of what parks should be. a place where city dwellers might go to find spiritual refreshment. But San Diego's not really a city, and its zoo offers no spiritual refreshment. I called public relations associate Christine Brennan at the zoo's marketing office to pitch these ideas. Was there someone with whom I could discuss them? We don't like comparisons with other zoos, she replied. Finally, she asked me to fax her a list of my questions. Dear Christine, I wrote, I'm interested in exploring the ways different zoos and animal preserves are designed and constructed. Can zoos be read as public spaces, as architecture? In what ways do they reflect the customs and values of the cities they're built in? She sent back a voicemail. I think your topic's too vague. We need to know exactly what you're looking for before someone can talk to you. Since I hardly knew this myself, I got in the car and went down to the zoo. My old friend Ray Johansson came along for the drive. When Panda Bayun was finally successfully inseminated in 1998, the birth of her baby, Hua Mei, was big news. Adult females usually only give birth once in a lifetime. Hua Mei's birth was a symbol of hope. The fifth captive panda born in America, her name means splendid, beautiful in Chinese. As China's panda habitats are daily destroyed by the very foresters who rescued Xi Xi, there's little chance the species will continue to live in the wild. But Bai Yan turned out to be such a great mother. She was the ultimate mammal, holding the cub, quote, nearly continuously on her ample front during the first 2 weeks, usually cuddled and warmed by her massive arms, Zoo News. Ray and I counted 42 different types of panda merchandise at the zoo's dozens of outlets, most of it featuring mother and child. There were panda bibs and placemats, panda spoons, panda shoelaces, panda socks, panda sweatshirts, t-shirts, and puzzles. Panda chocolate, panda olive oil, panda salad dressing, a panda cookie cutter. A panda Christmas tree ornament, a nightlight, a snow globe, refrigerator magnets, panda shot glasses and shooters, panda masks, panda kite, panda liquid soap dispensers, a panda switch plate, a panda stamped mouse pad. Ray and I settled for the panda topper slipper, which was a plastic takeout container of Coke decorated with pandas for $8.95. Like most institutions, the San Diego Zoo relies on corporate sponsorship. Among the logos displayed alongside pictures of pandas were Pacific Bell, Coca-Cola, Kodak, Delta Airlines, Icy, Crystal Geyser. Strangely, McDonald's was missing. After all, the simulated rainforest environment at the zoo is named for the Kroc family, who own most of McDonald's. In New Zealand, the branding of the McDonald's rainforest at the Auckland Zoo is unabashedly corporate. Still, this is rather ironic, because as Susanna B. Hecht, professor of Latin American Studies at UCLA, points out, quote, the optimistic market forecasts and real growth for the demand of cutter beef, which McDonald's, as the world's largest consumer and promoter of beef products, has stimulated, are an essential part of the large-scale deforestation and its biotic and social consequences in Latin America. The Crocs don't see it this way. As the curatorial text displayed in the Kroc family rainforest argues, will tropical rainforests be gone by the year 2050? Yes, as people demand more timber, firewood, cattle, and farmland. Like contemporary art, corporate linguistics seek to eliminate the dreary mechanics of cause and effect. Shit happens. People demand. Clearly, the San Diego Zoo's most prominent message beyond its Saturday mall crawl gestalt is that there will be no more wild. Corporations maintain animals because they are cute and genetically useful. Quote, tapirs have been on Earth for 20 million years, but most are gone now as people destroy their habitats, the Kroc text coyly explains. This is how Buffon described a tapir upon seeing one for the first time. The tapir is the size of a little cow, but without horns and a tail. It has short legs, and its body arcs just like a pig's. It wears a deer's livery when young, and later on a uniform of dark brown. It has a big, long head, with a trunk like a rhinoceros, 10 incisors and 10 molars in each jaw, features that distinguish it entirely from the cow. The tapir is a dark and sad animal. Ray and I drove home on the 5 through a very long dusk. He told me how he and his mother had traveled to El Rosario, Mexico, to see the migrating butterflies 6 weeks before she died. It was dusty, Ray said, and there were guys driving pickups who charged people a couple of bucks to go up the hill where the butterflies mated. But then when you got there, there were millions of butterflies everywhere. The ground was covered with butterfly corpses. It wasn't beautiful like they had thought, but still it was something. And then he told me how he'd been in the room when she died. It got dark around Irvine, and for the first time all day, we felt a slight kind of openness. Escape is vestigial, just like the wild.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being
yes,
on.
Yes, thanks for being on, Ellie Litt, and thank you everyone for showing up. It's great.
Okay, cool.